Thank you, Corinne, and thanks for and welcome to the CNODES Methods Workshop. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce Mireille Schnitzer, who is a new assistant professor in pharmacy at the University of Montreal, but comes from a very methodological background. She got her degrees, her undergraduate and master's degrees in math and stat at McGill, and her PhD in biostatistics at McGill. During that time, she did some work at University of California, Berkeley. She then did was a visiting student at University of Pennsylvania, a visiting fellow at University of Pennsylvania, and a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health. Right now, her research interests are in, there's a long list, but statistical methods applied to pharmacoepidemiologic research and large healthcare databases. She's had a very good start to her career. She holds a CIHR New Investigator Award and an NSERC Discovery Grant, along with an NSERC Accelerator Award, which are given, only a very few of these are given across the country to fund exciting new research at a high level. So that's a big honor for Mireille. She's also funded by the FRSQ. And she's going to tell us today about a topic that I think it's fair to say Mireille introduced to us in Montreal through her time in Berkeley and has become an area of research interest of mine and of others at McGill on targeted learning in pharmacoepidemiology. So.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for inviting me to speak here. Thanks so much to Robert and the CNODES team. It's really quite an honor. Yes, exactly. This is work that I started in my PhD. I started learning about sort of this perspective in estimation. The title of this talk is Getting Better Answers by Asking Better Questions. It sounds very applied, and it is, because the implications are absolutely appropriate in terms of questions we want to ask in policy and in patient care. But in fact, this requires a different type of statistical estimation. So I'm going to be focusing on the statistics underlying these concepts. So this is the overview of the talk today. It's in four parts. The first part will be on effect definition. So we are talking about causal effects and the estimation requirements, because we can't always estimate causal effects. We want to be very clear about when it is possible. Then the limitations of traditional approaches. I'm saying traditional in quotations because I might mean standard, like they're very common in current practice. Because if those didn't have limitations, then I wouldn't be proposing any changes or anything new. So that's really important to understand. Then we'll see the targeted learning roadmap, which is the full procedure from the data, from the conception of what you want to know, all the way through statistical estimation down to interpretation. And then we're going to talk about one of my particular interests, but I think it's actually really pertinent for CNODE studies, and that is variable selection in high dimension. So this is sort of more cutting edge topics, things that are a little bit more on the edge, like what I've done in the past year or so. So the first section, effect definition and estimation requirements. So with electronic medical data, it's quite an advantage to have access to real world data. And what do we mean by real world data? We mean we see people go through actual treatment regimes, their treatment changes, they have comorbidities, they are confounded for other treatments, and these are things that we just do not see in clinical trials. So this is a great advantage over clinical trials. In addition, we have a wider population. It's easier to become a participant in an observational study. Pretty much is a census of all users of certain healthcare systems. So a huge advantage over clinical trial data, which is one of the alternatives. But of course, randomized controlled trials can provide immediate access to some kind of a causal effect, especially if you're estimating intention to treat. Okay, then you pretty much go for a t-test at the end. You have two groups that receive different treatments. They are the same at baseline overall. And that's pretty easy, okay? And we're assuming that it's either intent to treat or a full adherence kind of trial. So, of course, observational data does not allow for such usage, so things get a little bit more complicated. And even when causal effect estimation is possible, the estimation procedure is far from being as simple in a clinical trial, and it's not always possible. So just to talk, why do I, you know, just to get us on the same page, drug effectiveness and safety. I know this is your bag. So just to give some like intuitive definitions before I give the formal definitions. Do patients taking a certain medication have better outcomes than a similar group not taking the medication? That would be effectiveness, okay? And you can think of that in a clinical trial context where we have two very comparable groups. Are patients taking a certain medication more likely to experience negative outcomes than a similar group not taking the medication? That would be safety. And then we might also be contrasting two competing medications, so that would be relative safety or effectiveness, okay? Does one medication provide better outcomes than the other medication? So relative safety, relative effectiveness. Then, if we establish a persistent correlation between a medication and a positive or negative outcome, and we have exhausted all other explanations for this correlation, we cannot think of an unmeasured confounder or another reason why we'd be seeing this correlation, we conclude that we have found a possible relationship. Okay, so part of the goal here is that we want to be able to characterize this relationship in terms of a causal effect to have more certainty about the conclusions of our study. So often I hear people say, oh, well, that's biased. But it's very hard to talk about bias if we don't have a very clear definition of the effect of interest, okay? Like a specific number that we are trying to target if we're thinking in a frequentist setting, which I will be doing for this talk. So bias is the estimation of an association, for instance, that misrepresents the unknown true effect, okay? So in epidemiology, there are terms for different types of bias or things that cause bias that can obscure this estimation. This includes indication or confounding bias, selection bias, information bias, and reverse causality also, where we're thinking that, well, in this case, it's the treatment would cause the outcome, but it's actually the outcome that is leading people to take certain treatments or to be prescribed certain treatments. So like I said, we need to start by defining what we mean by a true effect in order to define bias at all. And one great thing about causal inference is that it gives us tools to systematically determine whether bias might exist based on study design and subject matter knowledge. So although there are silly pictures, this is where I'm going to start talking about the formal definition of effectiveness. So an intuitive definition that people might start with, I'm talking about, you know, like the general population might think, did someone's outcome improve after taking a medication? And is that effectiveness? And that's often what people think of. But of course, this is a fallacy because this improvement might be independent of treatment, as in they could not have taken the treatment and still improved. So this is not an acceptable definition. The definition of an effect relies on defining the intervention and also defining the alternative. Okay? So it could be an alternative intervention or just no intervention, that's also allowable. So the individual level counterfactual or potential outcome definition, did that individual's outcome improve relative to the alternative? So here we see a sick patient, and you see the cursor? Yeah. And so they have the option, this could be in a clinical trial or in real life, they have the option of taking the green medication or the pink medication. We see one of the outcomes. So in this case, the patient took the green medication and remained sick. Here the patient took the pink medication and was healed. So we can say that there was an individual level causal effect, but it's that relative causal effect between the two treatments. Okay. So for every subject, we observe one or the other in any given instance. It might be the first time they're sick. We're looking at incident users of a medication for a specific disease. So we're only going to see each subject once when they're treatment naive. Okay. So we don't see the other. This is how we denote in notation, rather than in like silly little pictures, how we denote potential or counterfactual outcomes, which we often use interchangeably. So if the outcome is going to be called Y, okay, then Y superscript 1 is the outcome under treatment labeled 1, and Y superscript 0 is the outcome under treatment labeled 0. And therefore, the individual level effect, if we want to look at it as a difference, is Y1 minus Y2. Okay, so the difference in the outcomes. We can never observe this individual level effect because we can only observe one of the two potential outcomes. And this is why we aim to estimate something like mean potential outcomes, for instance. And we can estimate these things under several assumptions, which I'll mention in a moment. So to start with, what we want to do is estimate the average difference between the counterfactuals over a specific population. And it's very important to be able to define this population. And like I was saying before, with observational study data, electronic medical registry data, we have access to quite a wide population. And so that's how we'd be defining the population in that case. Okay, so this average difference is equal, because of how the expectation is linear, it's equal to the difference in expectations for the counterfactual under treatment 1 and then the counterfactual under treatment 0. So this means that we can estimate, so the interpretation is important and it's easy once you get your head around it, is that this is the mean difference between giving everyone in the population medication 1 versus giving everyone in the population medication 0. All right, and this requires right away that everyone has to be eligible to receive both medications. So that's absolutely necessary. And that contributes to how you define your population at the beginning of your study. So this is an example of a marginal effect. There are many, many effects. I'll go into it a little bit. And this is what is estimated in a clinical trial, especially when you have a continuous outcome. Okay, you might estimate this difference in expectations using a t-test. Well, you would test it using a t-test. So we already do this in clinical trials routinely. Okay, so these are the assumptions for when we can estimate this effect. When is estimation available? If these are not satisfied, then either we can't even define this effect, like it makes no sense to define this effect, or we can't estimate it. So there's a little bit of variability in why we need these. The first is well-defined treatment. It means that the intervention of interest is defined clearly, okay, meaning we can say specifically what we mean by an intervention, what you would do to this person, that's the intervention. But it could also be a category of interventions. They receive one of a class of medications, but we let the specific choice of medication be up to their physician. That's also allowable under a few, under like one additional assumption, actually. Like I said, positivity is the second assumption. In order for this effect to have meaning, it is necessary that everyone in the population could plausibly receive both levels of treatment. Okay, so no one's contraindicated for a treatment, things like that. The third is what we often think of as a major limitation of observational studies, and that is true. It is unconfoundedness. The set of adjustment variables used in the analysis can unconfound the analysis. It's a little bit circular, but what I mean is that those variables can remove all of confounding bias, and that's pretty much the definition that we use. Unless we want to write down the mathematical definition. And finally, one person's treatment doesn't affect another person's potential outcome under the treatment they actually received. And that's called non-interference. Okay, so in certain settings for non-infectious disease, for instance, this might be satisfied. But if we're talking about vaccination for infectious diseases, one individual who is unvaccinated might be protected by people around them being vaccinated. Okay, so their potential outcome, even under their treatment, is affected by other people's treatment. So in this case, it would be violated. Okay, and then you would need to use a bit more complicated methods that are under development. But we're going to look, these are the standard causal assumptions that we tend to see. And so we can use fairly standard causal inference to proceed with estimation in these cases. So causal inference also requires time ordering of the variables. So we have to formally acknowledge this. And in electronic medical data, it means that we have to define variables that formally acknowledge this. This is usually the case, I find. So it must be clear that all covariates are measured before treatment exposure is considered, okay, to make sure that there's a separation between those things. And treatment exposure occurs before outcome ascertainment. So these assumptions are needed for the definition of the causal effect. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a coherent effect definition. So far, we've seen effects defined as the difference between population means. Now, this could be a difference if the outcome is continuous. It could be a ratio. If the outcome is binary, it could also be a marginal odds ratio. We'll see in a little bit with an example. These are all population-level effects. Okay, we're saying if we treated everyone in the population, there would be this mean versus that mean, and we want to contrast them. Okay, now, this might be very useful for policy. But you might want to start to sort of get down into looking at individuals, looking at subpopulations, and that's also possible. Causal inference isn't just about purely marginal means. So it might be of greater interest to estimate stratum-specific effects. So for instance, if X is sex, you might want to know the difference in means for just women, okay, versus men. And you can do those two things separately if you have enough people, okay, within a stratum. But with limited data or a continuous covariate that you're still interested in conditioning on, we can pose a model, and then you actually have to specify a model for the conditional expectation of the potential outcome, conditional on that covariate that you're interested in, and then under treatment A. Okay, and you can look at it for treatment A is 0 and A is 1. And that will allow us to share information across values of X, okay? Because we're not going to cut up X and estimate for each one specifically, let's say if we don't have enough data to do that. Okay, and so here's an example of one type of model. And so for people who are familiar with causal inference, this is a marginal structural model. I just didn't use the word. But you see that you can estimate curves separately for the two potential outcomes across a range of values of X. So it could be age, for instance. And that allows us to look at treatment heterogeneity, effect heterogeneity, I mean. So you can see that for older people, if X is age, for instance, there is more of an effect. You'd prefer treatment one. And for younger people, you say, well, maybe there's not much of an effect, or maybe we would prefer treatment zero, okay, depending on what the confidence intervals look like. Okay, so that allows us to kind of look at how things change over some covariate. So this brings us closer to personalized medicine. And there's definitely steps being taken in this direction. We heard a really great talk yesterday at McGill that allows us to estimate these outcome models flexibly and put some covariates in. And so then we can see what effect heterogeneity looks like adaptively. So the models themselves can sort of like sort that out. This brings us closer to personalized medicine, even though we can never know the individual level. But we can look at someone in a specific subset and say, yeah, this medication looks like it might be useful for someone like you. Okay, so overall, causal inference, this is my definition, but it really does connect to the targeted learning framework I'll talk about soon. It's the combination of formal assumptions about the data. Okay, and this is structural. And it's also those assumptions that we saw before, like knowing that we need to have no unmeasured confounders, for instance. Clear effect definition. Again, not everybody agrees with this, but this is like what I think is one of the most important things about causal inference. We're very, very specific about what we're defining even before we start estimation. I haven't even started talking about estimation yet. This is all definition. The third step is then we do estimation. Then we get some kind of machine, and we turn the crank, and we spit out estimates for what we defined in the previous step. And then the last step is to carefully interpret our results. And that might be in light of the formal assumptions we made in step one. Is this a causal effect, or is it some kind of association, which we might be able to estimate when we're not actually able to estimate effects? And that could be a legitimate conclusion of your study and interpretable, just in a different way. So this is the overview of section one. Potential outcomes give us a coherent way to define what an effect is. We can define simple effects like contrasts between mean potential outcomes, like differences, ratios, odds ratios, or we can define more complicated models for effects for substrata. We can never observe individual level effects, but we can estimate mean effects under several causal assumptions, and these have to be discussed and critiqued by the investigator who knows the most about the subject in order for the conclusions to be properly evaluated by a reader. So that's the section one. So are there any questions at this point, especially questions for clarity? It's okay? Okay, so in that case, I'll move on to section two, which is limitations of traditional approaches. And so I want to try to give my interpretation of why we've moved ahead and we've started estimating, defining these marginal effects. So different statistical methods are built for different goals. Okay, sometimes this is glossed over. Definitely when students first learn different statistical methods, this might not really be a big focus. One is prediction, which is being able to predict a subject's outcome from covariates. Okay, this is what they do in computer science. This is what we do when we have AIC. Lasso is used for this. So that's an entire field of study on its own. Clustering is another goal of statistical analysis. This could be to describe relationships between different subjects, because you don't have an outcome. You just want to say, oh, these subjects are alike. These subjects are alike. Maybe there's a reason for that. Modeling is another goal in statistics. It's to produce a simplified template for a process that we can then interpret, to get like maybe a deeper understanding of a process. And finally, estimation is causal effects, associations, estimation of parameters. So there's definitely some overlap between these things. But it's also important to understand what the main goal of your study is. And if you want to borrow tools from other areas, you know, you need to be sure of why you're doing that. So in clinical research and epidemiology, we often don't differentiate clearly between these goals, even though the individual might understand the difference. And optimal practice would be to use the right tool for the job, but I've noticed among people close to me that current practice seems to be like always use regression, you know, and that's pretty much what everyone is taught. Okay, when you have a hammer, everything's a nail, right? So when I learned mixed models, I was like, mixed model everything, but then I sort of learned other things and I realized that that's not necessarily true. So in traditional statistical approaches, to be clear, we propose a model that represents the outcome process. So here we have the expectation of Y given an exposure A and confounder C. So you might put a linear logistic regression to represent this conditional expectation. So this model is made conditional on treatment type, and all covariates deemed necessary to unconfound the effect estimation. So we interpret effect by looking at the coefficient of the treatment covariate. Okay, and that's what we interpret as the effect of interest in any case, no matter what regression method we use. So the problem is that estimates obtained from this approach might be misleading even if all the causal assumptions are satisfied. You need to satisfy those causal assumptions. But even if you do, going this way might give you something misleading, which is distressing, which shouldn't happen, right? So I'm going to give three reasons, three problems with traditional methods. So the first one, and not all of them apply to everything, but the first one applies mostly to logistic regressions, which are extremely common, right? And this is the problem of non-collapsibility. So you've heard of non-collapsibility, the odds ratio. So if you use a logistic regression model to estimate an effect on a binary outcome, the resulting odds ratio is conditional on the covariates in the model. Okay? So this is different from a marginal odds ratio. And here's the marginal odds ratio. Probability of the outcome under treatment giving the result divided by probability of an outcome of treated one not giving the outcome. Okay. So why is this a problem? The way I decided to think about this is from a randomized controlled trial perspective. Okay, so you have a randomized controlled trial with two arms, a binary outcome, you have full adherence, and no confounders because you have full adherence since randomized control trial, so you don't have to worry about anything like that. So normally you wouldn't adjust for covariates, right? With a binary outcome, because you might with a continuous outcome, that makes sense. So logistic regression without covariates gives the marginal odds ratio. Okay, it gives this thing right away because you don't have confounders. However, if you add outcome predictors, the parameter of interest changes. You're estimating something different. And so this means what you mean, what you're targeting in your study, has changed as soon as you add a covariate if it predicts the outcome. If it's random noise, it won't do anything. Okay, but you're putting it in the model because it's something that predicts the outcome. Okay, so if you're doing that to improve prediction of an effect, well, what you've defined as effect has changed. And this is not current practice in clinical trials because people know this. Okay. But why would you want to estimate that thing in an observational study if it is inappropriate in a clinical trial? Sort of my point. In addition, if you do variable selection in a logistic regression for an observational study or for a clinical trial, every time you add or remove a variable, your effect of interest changes. Okay? So it's difficult. That variable selection is done for a prediction model, but here our goal is different. I wanted to take sort of the other perspective and say, suppose we do this. We fit a model conditional on suspected confounders and the observed treatment. You might say, well, I can interpret a conditional causal effect. That's another quantity, but it's still relevant. Okay, fair enough. But this is only possible if the model is correct, as in it correctly models the conditional outcome. Okay, and so normally for a statistician, for many people, they would reject this, okay? And this, so George Box has a quote attributed to him, which is, all models are wrong, some models are useful, okay? And that's reflected in his 1976 paper. A model is a tool to summarize a process, but it is not an exact description of nature. So saying this model is completely correct rather than summarize as well is difficult. But this is what you need to interpret that coefficient. And so I wanted to add in this slide, just to get sort of my vocabulary straight to make this pretty clear. When I talk about marginal effects using potential outcomes, this always has a causal interpretation regardless of the estimation methods used. Like I haven't even talked about estimation yet, really, for the marginal parameters. So for example, the marginal odds ratio contrasts the odds of obtaining the outcome had everyone taken treatment 1 versus treatment 0. To estimate marginal effects, it still might be necessary to adjust for confounders. Okay? So I just wanted to give that contrast between the estimate of a marginal parameter versus an adjusted parameter. Okay, you still need to adjust to get the marginal estimates. But on the other hand, standard regression methods produce estimates of conditional effects. So those two things are different. Okay, those are also adjusted, but that's a different definition of a parameter. Okay, so this emphasizes, so this whole discussion emphasizes the difference between choosing the estimation method to answer the scientific question of interest versus choosing the question of interest to conform to the analysis. Okay, so you can actually put a lot of work into deciding what exactly you want to get out of your study, what exactly your marginal parameter of interest should be, what kind of marginal structural model, conditional in which strata. That might be hard work. And that is completely separate, like I keep saying, from the analysis. And so, of course, I would rather have science choose the question of interest rather than have science dictated by what is estimable through the limited methods that we're comfortable with. Okay, so I know it's a bit uncomfortable to kind of move over and say, okay, I'm going to get some students working on this different thing that I have a hard time. Like, for sure, I get that from my colleagues. But this is the argument. So this is why new methods have been developed. So the second problem is high-dimensional covariate spaces. So this is just, we're all familiar with this, limiting the number of covariates that can be added to the regression model given the amount of data that you have. Okay, so for instance, it's obviously limiting to have 100 potential confounders and only 20 data points. We just stop and say, haha, like absolutely impossible. But then it's also pretty limiting if we have 1,000 data points and you know, let's say 800 potential confounders. Like we can technically fit that model, but we're not going to be getting good estimates. Okay, so it's even more limiting if we want to include interactions, polynomial terms. So parametric models just don't do well in this case, okay, in high-dimensional spaces. So when working with electronic medical data, this is basically what you have, right? There is a vast diversity of information that is collected. You have indicator codes, signaling, all of these things, like diagnosis, medication, test taken, test results, et cetera, et cetera. It's a huge space. You know your potential, you know your main potential confounders, but it's the idea of the high-dimensional propensity score that you may want to sort of access this resource and maybe get proxies for things that you haven't measured. So for a given cohort, some codes may never be present, so you have some very sparse indicators. Other codes may be empty. Other codes may be present but rare, so that gives you sparse covariates. The number of codes relevant to at least some patients is very high. So you really can potentially have a lot of covariates that matter in your analysis. And this gives you what we call a high dimensional covariate space. So high dimensional covariate space is something that parametric methods cannot handle. This is the third problem with traditional methods, and it is just bias. Okay, so suppose we fit a linear regression, which is the nicest case. Okay, so you have the expectation of the outcome conditional on treatment and all of your potential confounders. Say you have all of the confounders that you need to adjust this analysis. And so you'd be interpreting beta A as the effect of interest. Now, even suppose that this model is correct, so everything I just said about models being incorrect, just throw out the window. Suppose this is correct. Okay, and its conditional sufficient set of confounders, you can actually interpret beta A. This is like the nicest case. You can interpret beta A as the difference in the means of potential outcomes. Okay. However, the maximum likelihood procedure that estimates all of these betas optimizes the fit of the joint likelihood. It basically treats all of these betas the same way. It doesn't say, oh, beta A is special, so we're gonna estimate that. So it doesn't optimize the fit of beta A in particular. And this poses a potential threat, it should be of, finite sample bias. Okay, so if you have infinite data, this is gonna be fine. But in a finite sample case, you're not throwing all of your resources at beta A. You're spreading it out across a potentially high dimensional space of coefficients. Okay, so that's another problem with traditional methods, even linear regression, and even in this lovely, lovely case that otherwise would work pretty well. So you might say, okay, so if you have a high dimensional confounder space, why is it wrong to use flexible estimators that might throw something out if it's not particularly predictive of the outcome? I feel like this is sort of, for someone who has worked in prediction, this might be the next sort of idea you might come up with. So suppose we have a high dimensional covariate space and or uncertainty about the outcome model form. Now that second one is pretty much always the case. So why not use a flexible prediction method to automatically select covariates and features? So this could be of the outcome model, to be specific. So this can be as simple as doing backwards and forwards covariate selection, or it could be using a lasso, which is a little bit more specific about the loss function that it's targeting. Any of these methods, there's lots and lots of machine learning methods that you can use here. We could then interpret the impact of covariate A as the effect of interest, or the importance of A inside of the model, depending on what we're using. So here are a bunch of other examples. Regression trees are pretty interpretable. Support vector machines, more like a black box procedure to get flexible estimation, things like that. So unfortunately, flexible prediction models can make problem number three worse. So the goal of the prediction model is to optimally predict the outcome. This is why it's important to know exactly why a model has been built, like what it's doing. So I give an example, like when is this going to fail? So suppose, for instance, that there are many very predictive covariates in the data set, but A has a relatively small effect, okay, compared to these other guys, but it's still a clinically interesting effect. So we still want to know. A flexible method might even throw out the covariate A, just saying, okay, I don't have that much data. Here are big hitter predictive variables. A is not that important because it doesn't treat A as special, so it tosses it out because it doesn't help with prediction. Okay? And then what you would conclude is that A has no effect. But this might not be true. It's just not useful in the prediction model. Okay, so that's the distinction. There are other examples. Like, say you have, it might throw out a confounder, something that's actually an important confounder, but it's more predictive of treatment than it is of outcome, but it still changes the effect of interest. But that's not the goal of this model. The goal of the model is prediction. So it might toss out an important confounder. You get a confounded effect of your treatment effect just because you're using this flexible method. So this is not a great solution. So as an overview of section two, when used for estimation of effects, traditional methods obscure what the goal of the analysis is. Traditional methods might produce misleading estimates because they estimate a conditional parameter, which we've seen is problematic if it's non-collapsible. They don't adapt well to high-dimensional parameter spaces, and they can cause bias by not targeting the parameter of interest. So are there any questions at this point before I go on to the targeted learning roadmap? It's okay? It's clear? All right. So target learning roadmap. So this is a framework. It's an estimation framework for answering questions using data. So this comes from Vanderlaan, and Mark Vanderlaan and Sherry Rose wrote a book published in 2011 that describes this very carefully, chapter by chapter. It's a little bit statistical, but I think it's appropriate for quantitative epidemiologists. So it has the following structure. It starts with defining what we know, the situation, and what we want to know, which is the effect of interest. Then it estimates the effect optimally. Okay, and so this is very contentious, right? There are lots of different ways to do that. Interpret the results based on the presence or absence of a necessary causal criteria. Okay, so here it is. It's going to be a rainbow. You ready for it? So the first step is data and model M. So define the structure of your data using subject matter and experimental knowledge. Okay, the next step, I'm going to go through all these carefully. This is the structure of the section. The next step is to define the quantity, effect of interest. We talked about this. So this is the first section, which I call define. The next step is to estimate all necessary components of the unknown function that generates the data. And you might use SuperLearner for this. Okay, so in the traditional framework that they put down, we use SuperLearner, so I'll be talking about that. The next step is to use targeted minimum loss-based estimation to combine the results that we get from SuperLearner in a way to target the parameter of interest, the causal parameter of interest. And then you can also estimate the variance. So these two steps are the estimate step. So these are this is the machine, okay, these two blocks here. And then the last step is interpretation, like I mentioned. So under some untestable assumptions, that's important, right? These causal assumptions are untestable. We can interpret the results as an estimate of a causal effect or as a purely statistical parameter estimate, which you can call an association, but has a specific definition, and that's interpretable. Okay, so we're going to go through these. So the first step is data and model. So here's an example, just so that we can like get something concrete. Suppose that we are interested in estimating the relative safety of inhaled corticosteroids for the treatment of mild persistent asthma in pregnant women, and the outcome is birth outcomes. Okay, so we're interested in whether or not this is harmful for the fetus. Okay, and so this is a simplification of a study done by Benoit Cossette with Lucie Blais in 2013, published in Thorax. So in their study, all subjects have been categorized as having, so these are the mothers, they've been categorized as having mild persistent asthma, and they subsequently delivered past 20 weeks. So to be included in this delivery cohort, that was the definition. So the data are C, these are the baseline covariates measured prior to 20 weeks gestation. So these are my definitions, okay, this doesn't exactly reflect the study that they did. But these are all measured prior to 20 weeks gestation. A, which is the exposure of interest or the treatment. One is taking ICS at 20 weeks, okay, or an estimate of that. Y is, the outcome is small for gestational age, okay, as an example. So because of this data extraction that I describe or something along these lines, we know that these variables are strictly time ordered. We know that C precedes A, which precedes Y. So C is selected to include all risk factors for the outcome in particular, and there's reasons for this. The outcome being small for gestational age, that are suspected to affect treatment decisions as well. That's usually sort of the rough definition we have of a confounder. This means that the underlying data generation has three components. We're going to be talking about the likelihood function or the underlying data generation without using math. So the first step is the process that selects C, that selects which C manifests in the population. The next is the process that selects which treatment A is taken conditional on C. And the third is the process that selects whether the outcome occurs conditional on A and C. So those are three components. Okay, so this is called the likelihood. The process that selects C, we treat it as random sampling. So we treat this completely empirically. We say it's 1 over N. The probability of which C manifests is 1 over N for each subject's covariates. The process that selects whether treatment A is taken conditional on C. Okay, the probability that A is equal to little a, so treatment 0 or 1, conditional on C, we're going to call that G of little a. All right, and that's going to be modeled. Finally, the process that selects whether the true outcome occurs, conditional on A and C, is going to be called, so that's the probability that the outcome occurs, probability Y is equal to 1, conditional on A and C, we're going to call that QA. That's also going to be modeled. And these are the two things that are required for estimation in first estimation of the marginal mean in this context. So do we have any restrictions we can place on the model M? So that's what this part is. When we're defining the model M, we're saying, well, what do we know? Okay, other than what I just said. So everything I just mentioned is important. So one thing is that we know all probabilities are between 0 and 1. Okay, like basic. We assume that we can estimate common models for GA and QA. So that's going to be, we can take all of the subjects and model this and estimate the same models. Okay, they're all part of the same data generating function. We can also assume, maybe in this case, we can assume that all subjects are independent. If not, we might do some kind of clustering thing. Okay. Can we also say that the probability that A is equal to A conditional on C, which is GA, can we say that this has a logistic regression form? Now, this is the propensity score, by the way. I didn't really mention that. Can we say that the propensity score has a logistic regression form? Like, does that come from information from the scenario? So not really, right? We never know that a priori, because right now we're just talking about things we know. So we don't know this. We don't know that magically treatment, unless it's like assigned in this way, we don't know that it has this logistic form. So why can't we do that? And why is that a bad idea? So if we decide a priori that we should be modeling the propensity score as logistic regression or any parametric functional form of GA and QA, we could be wrong. Right? We could get something that's pretty far off just by using the wrong form. We might be missing interactions, for instance, also. We might be missing squared terms or whatever. So if we are wrong, then the estimation of the parameter, the effect of interest that we're targeting, it might be biased. And that's why you want to really avoid being wrong here and making unnecessary parametric assumptions. So overall, we need to be conservative in the structure we place on M. So for consistent estimation, we say that we require that M contains the true model space. The true model space is something extremely specific that nobody knows. So like the truth is very specific, but we don't know it, so we have to be very general, okay, in order to capture that truth. So that's the idea. Mathematically, it would just be the model contains the truth. So here are some other examples of model restrictions, okay, like what you're doing at this first step. Like I mentioned, it might be possible that independence between subjects is too strong an assumption. For instance, you might want to model the clustering inside of hospital centers. So we might assume dependence, okay, in hospital clusters, which we did with Robert. We did this in one paper. If treatment was randomized, so you can actually use this if you're working from a clinical trial perspective, you can use this estimation framework, and you know then that the propensity score is a constant. Okay, so you can estimate it as a constant. You might have a much more complicated data set. So here's a DAG. Structural restrictions can be represented by the absence of arrows in a directed acyclic graph. Okay, that's commonly used. It's just an example. I'm not going to go through this, but like here you have two different treatments. You have an outcome. You have time-dependent confounding. And you have some other variables. Okay, so you can write this down, and that represents what you mean by your model restrictions, the absence of arrows. You're saying this cannot affect that, so we keep that out. Okay, so that was defining the model. The next step is the quantity of interest. We talked a lot about this already. So the example in the last situation, I thought that the marginal risk ratio would be appropriate in that case. So that would be comparing all versus no women taking inhaled corticosteroids. But you could also estimate the marginal odds ratio if that was more interesting. As mentioned previously, this quantity or parameter of interest, that's the language that I usually use, should respond to the scientific question and can be more or less complex depending on what use you want to make of it later. So it can be entirely policy, or it can try to look at some of the scientific questions of interest. So the next step is a more mathy part. So using the model M from the previous step, we need to write down this quantity, which we call psi, so the effect of interest that we've been defining, as a function of the observed data. Okay, so this has been done. This has been done for many parameters in different contexts. And that sort of makes up the bulk of the targeted learning literature, actually, up to this point. So if this is impossible, then the parameter of interest is not estimable from the data. So maybe you need to adjust your scientific question of interest, because it is true that you can't do whatever you want with the data that you have. And so at this point, you might need to check yourself and say, is that possible? Okay. So in this example, a very simple case, we have that the probability of the outcome under taking ICS, which is equal to the expectation of QA, Q under ICS, is equal to, so this Q here is something estimable. So Q is the probability of the outcome conditional on A and C. That we can estimate from the data. So with those causal assumptions that we made previously, we can connect this first part here, this probability, to this expectation. Okay, it takes a few steps. It's actually not immediate. Okay, so that's the work we have to do in this stage, unless it's been done before. And then you just have to check your causal assumptions. You just say, do I have them? Then I know that this is okay. Okay, so it's also important to note that the causal parameter psi is defined in terms of an intervention on the data generating distribution. Okay, and if you look in the book, this is like fleshed out in mathematical detail, but I thought that it would be nice to visualize this again in the DAG. And remember that we're intervening on this A node over here. Okay, so we're setting capital A is equal to ICS or non-ICS. Okay, we're saying you're taking this treatment or you're not. So that's how the effect is defined. And then we can look at this quantity psi, which is a contrast between two different worlds, a world where we took ICS and a world where no one took it. And this has to be plausible, by the way. That's why it's mild persistent asthma. That's why it's the example, so that it's possible for them to have not taken it theoretically. So it has two parts. We might estimate these separately. I tend to estimate them separately. So the first probability here contains the intervention A is equal to 1, and the second one contains the intervention A is equal to 0. Okay, so that was defining the parameter of interest, making sure that it is estimable from the data, and now this part is about estimating the parameter of interest. To proceed with estimation, we must fit models to estimate QA, okay? So, and that's because if we estimate QA, we can just take a mean and we get an estimate of the causal parameter. Okay, so without knowledge of its true form, it's like I was saying, we can't say, oh, I know that's a logistic regression, so we don't know, so what are we going to do? We can use flexible prediction methods here to estimate QA. Okay, and the reason why we do this is because we want something that will get us as close as possible to the true form of the model. Okay, nothing can select our confounders for us. We need to say, here are all the things that could possibly be confounders. Okay, nothing can go outside and be like, I found it, but it can figure out which interactions are important, which square terms, which weird functional forms that we didn't know a priori. These methods ideally can select that for us, and that's the whole reason why we do something flexible. Okay, so many of these methods exist in the literature. Flexible means that the models will adapt to the data and not assume a strict functional form. So a logistic regression says this is a functional form and we're going to go with it. But then you might do something a little bit more flexible like variable selection. But then you might use like a logistic lasso, and that's even more flexible. Then it's still assuming this linear form, but it's selecting variables in a different way and sort of shrinking coefficients. And then there's something much more flexible like random forest, which is just like really, really, really non-linear. Okay? And there's lots of different methods like that. And so there's like a scale of flexibility. So adaptive methods will... Because this is sort of like an idea that I always have in my head. Adaptive methods will automatically select variables, seek out important interactions, and determine the functional form by investigating the observed data. So this is the data mining stage. This is data mining. With more data, these models, good adaptive models, will be able to be more complicated. And with less data, these models will automatically remain simpler. Okay, so it adjusts to the amount of data you have, which is nice. Depending on the true underlying model, the best prediction method will vary. So I can't always say, wow, random forest is super flexible, use that. It works very well in some settings, like when they're predicting Netflix viewing. I think random forest won that one, okay? But it's not true in every setting, okay? And that's really important. So a priori, you can't know. And we need to remember that the goal is to optimize prediction. Therefore, it is necessary to determine what we mean by predictive success. Okay, so we need to think hard about what's our goal in estimating a model for Y. Okay, because that's it. We're going to be putting these things to estimate QA, and that means Y is the outcome, and we're conditioning on A and the covariates. So if we're estimating a model for a binary Y, we might want to minimize the number of incorrect predictions. I think that's pretty commonly used. So that would be the number of mistakes in predictions. You're predicting 0, 1, and you want to minimize the number of errors. If we're estimating a model for a continuous Y, we often want to minimize the mean squared error. So that's the sum of the differences between the true Ys and the predicted Ys squared. Okay, or you might want to minimize area under the curve. There's lots of different things that you can do. Okay, so that's what you're going to be directing your prediction methods towards when you're estimating QA. So with enough model flexibility, it's always possible to fit your data exactly. But of course, this is not useful. This kind of prediction model will not represent an underlying process. It's mechanical. It's connecting the dots. So in this case, if you have these data points, you might fit a line through them. That might be a great model. Okay. So in this case, I'm saying linear regression works well, which is possible. And if you were over-predicting and used something very flexible that didn't adapt to the sample size, you might just be connecting the dots and get something really terrible. For instance, if we have a new data point, then this might be pretty far from the predicted location of the red line, but pretty close to that linear regression, which kind of takes a simpler curve, a less adapted curve through the middle. So we want to be able to obtain a statistic on how well each method predicts without overfitting. This is like a mini course in computer science. So out of sample validation, the way we do this, the way we avoid over-adapting to the data, is we estimate the error using only subjects that were not used to fit the model. It's how we evaluate how the model is fit. So we have a whole sample S, which is this first orange box here. We split up, for instance, we split up the data into two pieces, one we build the model, and then one we test the error. Okay, so we evaluate the model built in S0 based on the error in S1. Okay, so that might be problematic because maybe our initial sample isn't very large and so we're wasting data. We're only fitting the model on half the set. So what we can do is partition the data set into five or more groups. So we can partition the data set into, for instance, five groups. So we split S into S1 to S5. So we build the model on four of the five subsets, S1 to S4, and we test it on the fifth subset. Okay? And then we repeat this. So then we build on S1 to S5, we test on S1, and we do it again and again and again. And then we take the average error. Okay, the error has been tested on every single one of those five partitions. We take the average across, and that's called the cross-validation error. And that's what's used in SuperLearner. Okay, so this is how I'm introducing SuperLearner. SuperLearner is a method that takes an optimal combination of the results of a library of different methods. And so remember when I said that no one of these might work well? We just don't know. We don't know which one of these will work well, so we fit them all. Okay? It is computational. So the first one is a logistic regression with main terms. The next one could be logistic regression with all second-order interactions. There's a stepwise variable selection. Here's lasso. Here's Bayesian regression trees. Here's random forests. Just an example. I mean, there are so many different things you can put in here. Parametric models are good to put in here, by the way, just as one option because they might do well. From each of these methods, you get a prediction estimate. So that's y hat. And I labeled it with the library location. And then you get an error. Okay. So discrete SuperLearner picks Y hat with the lowest E. That's all it does. It just says which one did the best. And we're going to go with that. So in this case, I pretended that Lasso did the best. Okay. So in that case, discrete SuperLearner would pick that one. Okay. But SuperLearner is different. Instead, it takes a weighted average of all of the predictions. Okay, so here we have the how we're modeling the expected outcome y, and this is just these alphas are the weights for each method. So this is the prediction from the first method. It gets a weight alpha 1. So if y hat 1 was very good at predicting, was better than everything else, it will get the largest weight, alpha 1. All right, in this case, we saw that y4 was the best, so alpha 4 will be 0.8. And the other ones will be like 0.1 or lower. So this is an optimal combination of predicted values. The values of the weights are found through linear or logistic regression of the cross-validation predictions of the outcome on the of the predicted outcome on the observed outcome. Okay, so that's a technical point, and I'm not going to go into more detail, but these weights are found through a specific regression step. So as a recap, SuperLearner combines the predictive power of any number of algorithms. Right? You can put a lot of stuff in there. In doing so, and this is really the key, and you can once you play with SuperLearner a little bit, you start to see this, it combines important features of each method to create a highly flexible overall predictor. So for example, and this I observed in practice, let's say you generate y using interactions and squared terms, okay, for your outcome model. You have them in one, and so you use it using a logistic form, and then you fit these two things in separate logistic regressions. One of your logistic regressions has interactions, the other has squared terms. You can put them separately into SuperLearner and get correct predictions for your outcome, things that work well. So this works very, very nicely. Okay, and this is what you want. So you don't actually need any of these things to work properly, but the combination might do better. And so that's it. In practice, the combination can do better than anyone individually. So in the targeted learning framework, we use SuperLearner to estimate QA. And so I sort of, so this is what I've been talking about the whole time. I sort of glossed over this other point, was that SuperLearner uses cross-validation to weight each algorithm according to its predictive ability. Okay, that's because the errors are estimated in a cross-validated way, and the predictions for each SuperLearner library method are estimated using cross-validation. So that's the super learner step. The next step is to target the parameter of interest using targeted minimum loss based estimation. So as we saw before, the super learner estimate QA might produce bias in the estimation of the effect of interest. So if we just say, okay, we have QA, let's just take a mean, and then we'll have an estimate of the expected marginal outcome. Okay. And that could work well, but like we saw before, when you're using something overly flexible, you might throw out important confounders, you might throw out the treatment of interest, okay? So it might give you a terrible estimate of the effect. So the next part is to use targeted minimum loss-based estimation, which is a bias-reducing step specifically for the effect of interest, and that's why it's important to do this step rather than to skip it. So TMLE updates the estimation of QA. The initial estimate is from SuperLearner, and then TMLE updates it to target the effect of interest. Okay, it does it in a very specific way. This updating step is derived in a way to produce estimates with good properties. Okay, good semi-parametric properties. That is the entire purpose. These properties apply exclusively to the estimation of psi. That's why it's targeted. Okay. It's not targeted to the estimation of QA or to a regression with many parameters. It is for one parameter. For the marginal probability of a binary outcome, in the example that we have, which is the probability YA is equal to 1, which is psi, the update step involves the propensity score also. So this is something that uses the propensity score. It just does that outcome modeling as an extra step. So you can look at it from the other way, too. It's like propensity score estimation with outcome modeling tacked on, right? So we're going to do inverse weighting in there somewhere. Therefore, we also need an estimate of GA, okay? So we often use SuperLearner there as well. So usually we say, okay, we're going to SuperLearn QA and GA. So we have estimates of both of these quantities that we need, and then we go through the TMLE steps. So if we consider the same parameter psi and the data is confounders, treatment, and outcome, TMLE has minimum standard error for semi-parametric models for large samples when GA and QA are correctly specified. It might have a really nice low standard error in finite samples too, but this is the specific statistical property, okay? It is guaranteed to have the lowest asymptotic standard error okay? But GA and QA have to be correctly specified, so that's called local efficiency. The other property of TMLE is that it is double robust. So if either GA or QA is correctly specified, then the estimate for psi will be unbiased in large samples. So this is really nice, because instead of having one model to fit with SuperLearner, we have two. And if either one works well, then we're consistent. Okay, it gives us two shots at the goal. So the idea of SuperLearner is that it increases the chance of correct specification. So if you get both correctly specified, you're minimizing your standard error. Or you're guaranteeing that minimum standard error, actually, I should say. But also, if you get either one correct, you're reducing bias. Okay, you're minimizing bias. So that's the goal. That's why SuperLearner here is you're putting your best shot at GA and QA in order to guarantee these statistical properties. And another nice bonus is that when we want to do variance estimation, is that this is provided by the TMLE structure because we're using semi-parametric structure, and so we have asymptotic estimates of variance, which often does very well, especially in large samples. So under certain restrictions of the SuperLearner algorithm, we have a closed form variance estimate. Another approach, if you don't have a really, really large sample, is to use statistical resampling methods like Bootstrap to obtain better finite sample standard error. So this is a really robust approach as well. And yeah, sometimes works better than the asymptotic form. And the final step in the targeted learning roadmap is to review the interpretation of your results. Can we consider a result to be an estimate of a causal effect, or is it the estimate of an association? And so in order to answer this question, we need to go through all the causal assumptions. Do they hold? Why are they, you know, which ones are not true? If we know we have unmeasured confounding, what can you do? In particular, do we believe that we have measured all potential confounders and included them in the SuperLearner? I think the next slide, So if we do believe that unmeasured confounders exist, what can we do? We can validly interpret the estimate as a purely statistical association that has been adjusted for the set C, which is insufficient for the effect estimation, but is still interpretable because you can, because as epidemiologists, you can imagine, okay, so I know we don't have smoking, but I know which way this effect estimate would go if I included it in, which might be sufficient in certain cases. It would go up, but we already have a large effect, positive effect, so we're okay. That's sort of like doing an informal sensitivity analysis. And that's another option. So you might perform a sensitivity analysis to gauge whether missing confounders would have an impact on the clinical conclusion. So these are two options of what you might do. Normally in the targeted learning framework, we talk about the first one, but I think the second one is very, very important in causal inference as well. So here's section three, an overview of section three. So the targeted learning roadmap encourages us to be clear and conservative about the a priori structural knowledge of the data, okay, to not throw in parametric models when we don't believe that those are true. Be clear in the definition of the goal of the study to define the effect of interest clearly and marginally. Three is to use flexible modeling methods like SuperLearner or another, you know, ensemble learning method that works to estimate all necessary components of the underlying data generating process. In the case that we saw, it was GA and QA. But there are more complicated cases with many different components. The fourth step is to use TMLE to produce better, and by better I mean reduce bias and minimal standard error estimates of the effect of interest. And the fifth step is to be critical and transparent in the interpretability of the estimate, okay, by critiquing our initial causal assumptions. Okay, so are there any questions about section three? Yes?
So in the phase where SuperLearner is trying different models, does it have to make an assumption of the lowest common denominator model? So there might be models like the main effects model where you could have variables in there. But then the second order model, you might get a situation where it's not estimable. You've got more variables or something like that.
Oh, you mean in the case where there's not enough data to estimate interactions?
Seems to me in a practical sense it would need to handle that in some way, or you would need a lowest common denominator across all those models.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You need to have that SuperLearner, that the methods put into SuperLearner either contain the truth individually or some kind of combination of them, and it's that linear combination form would be able to give a good prediction of the outcome. So that's sort of the idea? And that you have enough data to estimate that correct model or those correct components of the model.
Yeah. So how does it do that if you have for one of the models enough data, but because a different model has more variables in it, maybe because there's more variables, there's not enough data to do that estimation. Do you then take those main effects out of the simpler model because you can't do the second order effects in?
Oh, you mean how practically would you approach
yes.
that? Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so yeah, it might work well that you don't have main effects in your. I know that's sort of heresy when we usually talk about statistical modeling, but you might not put main effects into a second model, just the interactions, and maybe that would pick up the feature, but maybe not because you might need the main effects to kind of center it and then have the interaction. Or you might pick up do something more flexible like a tree method that will automatically model many interactions. Okay, so like absolutely that's true. So you need to be sort of crafty about how you insert things into SuperLearner, and it definitely depends on that. It's so if it seemed to be saying that SuperLearner is magic and you will always get a correct model, it absolutely depends on what you're putting in, how much data you have, whether these things can be properly modeled in the individual methods. That's true. Any other questions? We'll have questions at the end if there's time also. But this is, I think we do. This is the last section here, is variable selection high dimensions. I love talking about this all the time. This is just sort of an overview of the difficulties, I think, in this problem. So here I talk about inverse probability of treatment weighting, and this is hopefully a little bit more familiar. This simply involves weighting the outcomes by the inverse of the probability of receiving treatment, roughly the propensity score. So this approach requires correct estimation of GA. If you have correct estimation of GA, then this is absolutely a causal inference method. It can absolutely be used to estimate marginal parameters. But unfortunately, it does not have the minimum standard error property. Okay, so it is in the same class of methods as TMLE, but it does not have that efficiency property for asset for large amounts of data. Okay. It's also on the worst thing that if you've used IPTW, I'm sure you've noticed that it's unstable under sparsity. And in particular, when 1 over GA, those weights, where's my cursor, 1 over GA, when it becomes large, like very large, as in the propensity score is giving you estimates near zero, those weights get huge, and then this estimator behaves erratically. And so usually it really underperforms anything else, including outcome modeling methods. So you might think, and a lot of people have done this in the literature in the past few years, one might choose to estimate GA, the propensity score, with SuperLearner, okay? Because it requires adjustment for a sufficient set of confounders. Oh, I put W here. Sorry, this should be C. So, oh no, sorry, that is what I meant. So a sufficient set of confounders I'm calling W. So that might be a subset of C. You might have some stuff that you don't actually need, but you feel like you might need it, or your reviewers think that you might need those covariates. So it's actually a subset of that you might need. Okay, that could be of any size. W might be a large set. Okay, C might be huge. The model form of GA is generally unknown, so you might say, okay, let's use SuperLearner here, and then that makes sense intuitively, absolutely. So SuperLearner, like I kind of was introducing this way, it can be thought of as a kind of variable model feature selection procedure. Okay, just very flexible, averaging over lots of different methods. It weights the most predictive models most heavily. These models, so the models that are weighted most heavily, will include variables and model forms that are the most predictive of A. Okay, think of it in that way. So let's say you have a variable that is only predictive of A, nothing to do with Y, but you accidentally stuck it into your list of variable C. SuperLearner, when it's estimating GA, is definitely going to take that variable in one of its models at least, and it's going to use it to predict A, because it's a great predictor of A. Okay, so it is very likely, if you're doing a large database search, if you're doing like high-dimensional propensity score kind of thing, that some indicators could be highly predictive of A. They're used in diagnosis, but conditionally independent of Y, because you have something better that predicts Y. Okay? It's still going to be selected. So these are called conditional instruments. They're not an instrument because they would be predictive of Y, except that you found something that predicts the same component of Y or does a better job at it. Okay? So that's more important to put into your model. But these methods are going to select this conditional instrument in the estimation of GA. Okay? So including them in IPTW can be highly disadvantageous, okay, in particular for IPTW because... Well, actually, no, here. The reason why it's highly disadvantageous is because you're over-predicting A. So you know when the probability of receiving treatment 1 or 0, you know when that probability is going to be very, very small, close to 0. So when you estimate 1 over G, that's going to be a very, very large number. If you don't have that covariate, you can still get unbiased estimation because it's not a confounder conditional on the other variables you've included. It's just an instrument, so it is useless. And so that's why you don't want to overpredict G. Okay, this is generally pretty well known, but it is still so... It seems like such a good idea to be flexible in your estimation of GA because what other options are there? Okay, and that's why TMLE is so useful, because you actually can get away with it. It works well. I'll show you some simulations later. So here's graphically what I mean, including instruments in GA. So here's one graph where you have two what we would all call confounders. So C1 affects A and Y, and then we have C2 independently affecting A and Y. Okay, so you need to adjust for both C1 and C2 in this graph when you're estimating the effect of A on Y. Now, in the second graph, there's a slight difference. C1 affects A and Y, but now C2 affects A and C1 only. So if you adjust for C1, C2 is no longer a confounder, and you don't need to adjust for it. It only affects A in this case, once you block C1 here. Okay? So SuperLearner would pick C2, would say, wow, this is great in estimation of GA, but in estimation of Y, it would not pick it, okay, if you have C1 in the data set. Okay. Okay. So we see there are many studies that actually showed that including instruments or near instruments, meaning it has a variable that has a strong effect on A and a very weak effect on the outcome, it can harm estimation in IPTW in particular, but also in other causal effect estimators. So adding instruments to the propensity score will increase the finite sample estimation variance without reducing bias. This was shown in Brookhart in 2006 and a paper by Genevieve Lefebvre, Robert Platt, 2008. Large sample variance will also increase arbitrarily for an instrument that is closely associated with A, and this was, we showed this very recently. If the instrument is falsely believed to be a confounder, the positivity assumption may artificially seem to fail. So you might say, conditional on these confounders, some people should never have received treatment, but they were irrelevant. It was just their location at the time that made them not eligible for treatment. It wasn't their personal characteristics. Okay, in that case, that would be an instrument, which could be useful in another setting, but in when we're doing this kind of causal effect estimation, it's actually disastrous to put to include that variable as a potential confounder, because you would say, oh, well, I just can't do anything. I'm done. Or I need to restrict my population or something like that. So we did a simulation study in this recent paper in IJB. So what we did is we said, suppose we have a large number of suspected confounders C. This includes some instruments and some pure risk factors. But only a subset was needed to adjust for confounding. So we wanted to see how the different methods worked, using superlearner, using not superlearner. So the simulation study evaluates three methods of estimating GA for IPTW. Now, we use a logistic regression conditional on the true W, which you wouldn't know in practice. We used a logistic regression conditional on all of C, which you would have in practice, so that makes sense. And then we tried superlearner on all of C to see if it could like do a good job for IPTW. And so these are the results of the study. So we did it with three different sample sizes. I'll show you in a sec. This is the squared error and bias, so median squared error, median bias. Estimates were taken over 1,000 generated data sets. And the true value is 2. Okay, the true value of the difference in means is 2. So in this first case, we have basically a baseline. If we knew W, this is how much bias we would have in IPTW. Without adjustment, we have this. So if we just did not adjust at all, this is how much bias exists in the data set. If we throw them all in, we do a little bit worse for bias. If we look at median squared error, which also sort of gives us an idea of the variance, we do a lot worse. Okay, when we put in everything, because there's just too many covariates for the sample size. So it creates large weights sometimes, and then we get a lot of variance. When W is unknown, we might use superlearner. And in that case, we get a lot more bias compared to just throwing everything into IPTW in the logistic regression as main terms, which is all we need in this case. Instead, if we throw in superlearner, you get something crazy, and then you also get much worse median squared error. So this is an example of where it does really badly. It's really easy to show. You don't have to try very, very hard to show IPTW failing in this case. So when you have 1,000 data points, you kind of see the same sort of thing happening. You have some bias when you know W. Actually, for whatever reason, you do. Actually, I do know. You do better when you put all of C in here, but you do worse in median squared error, okay, which might be your target. And then if you do superlearner, you do quite a bit worse for both bias and median squared error. So, and then you have for 5,000, sort of similar from the last case where you just do worse with superlearner. Okay, so it doesn't go away very quickly with larger sample sizes. So I want to say, what time do I have to finish? Sorry, I didn't have the schedule on me. Oh, okay. Perfect. So I wanted to have a few comments on high-dimensional propensity score. So the key idea is that you can reduce estimation bias by automatically identifying variables in the electronic medical data that have a potential to confound. Now, this is a great idea, right? Utilize a large data source, okay, in order to maybe get some combination that is a proxy for something we haven't directly measured, right? So the coherency of this method assumes that adding new variables will never increase bias in large samples. So that is something that we'll always need when we do variable selection, okay, that saying, oh, this is related to the outcome, we assume we're not increasing bias. We're saying, okay, that change must be for the better. So the HDPS starts by limiting the variable selection to the most prevalent codes because some are just extremely, extremely sparse. So this is how it thinks to make the most usage of a large amount of data. The algorithm then prioritizes each variable in terms of the change it would produce in the risk ratio estimate. It starts with an adjustment set, things you already knew, and that's good. And then it does this prioritization separately for each variable to be added. And that's what makes it fast, so that's another great thing. Okay, and so then it gets sort of like a list of priorities and things that would change this variable, this effect estimate the most. So now back to this example with the DAG. So adding instruments or near instruments will increase variance without reducing bias. We've seen this. both C1 and C2, if we look at them independently, they will appear to reduce bias in the estimation of the risk ratio for A on Y. Okay. However, C2 is not helpful. It might not do anything. If you have a lot of data and you don't have many covariates, it might be okay, but it might actually be harmful to include because it might inflate variance. And when it inflates variance, it might change finite sample bias. Okay, so you actually could get more bias by including something like C2. So one more thing that I was thinking about recently. So some people have started using HTPS as a screening method, because if you have a massive space of variables, and it's very hard to fit SuperLearner on this huge space of variables because of computational issues, you can pick a method, and they have methods like this in genetics where they do something really fast, like they just go through and do a lot of t-tests or something like that to reduce your covariate space quickly. And so high-dimensional propensity score can be used in that way, and it can be used with any individual method put into your SuperLearner. So you can actually test out different variable screening methods inside of SuperLearner, okay, and not rely on it. You can use different types of variable screening methods instead of saying this one's the one that's going to work, because sometimes it can work very well, and I think there have been examples in the literature where it worked very well or appeared to work very well, but it's not necessarily always the case. Okay, so it can, but that's the same problem we had before, so we can include it as part of one of the methods, and that's been implemented already also. So I wanted to show you the results with TMLE to kind of show you how it compares to IPTW. Using separate SuperLearners to fit both GA and QA adaptively. Because TMLE is not immune to this instrumental variable issue. GA is still going to select instruments or conditional instruments. But now we're also fitting this outcome model QA. And so I really was surprised by these results, actually. I thought TMLE would fade as quickly as IPTW does, but it would accrue as much variance. But it does not, because having QA lets us kind of balance out the two models. And if GA is acting erratically, TMLE tends to use QA more. That's the double robustness criteria. Like, if QA is doing well, TMLE will go with QA. So here we see that this is sort of the base case. If we know W, TMLE has lower bias in this example than IPTW. It's finite sample, so it won't necessarily always be the case. It does have lower median squared error. It will generally perform better in terms of variance than IPTW. That's pretty consistent. When we throw all of C in, so the big set of covariates without knowing W, TMLE does better than IPTW in terms of bias and variance again. And then when we use SuperLearner, when it got worse for IPTW, it got better for TMLE. Okay, so that's, okay, this is very small bias, so I guess it's not that big of a deal, but this is almost like, this is really shrinking the median squared error over here. Okay, so at least it doesn't get much, much, much worse when you have no idea what your forms of, I'm actually using the correct form in GA and QA. Okay, but when you don't know and you use SuperLearner, it's not going to go crazy. It's not going to do something terrible and overfit and give you bad results like it does in IPTW. So that's nice. So we get sort of, I think we get similar results here. The bias increases a little bit over here, but the median squared error is reduced from using all the covariates to using TMLE, using SuperLearner and TMLE. And you pretty much get the same thing, whether you know W, whether you have all, or whether you use SuperLearner for TMLE when you have 5,000, when you have N equals 5,000 in this case. Okay, so it does what you want. All these three things are converging. They're using the correct models, so you'd expect something like that. So how do you explain this TMLE performance? So TMLE will have increased variance from including instruments. Okay, it's not a free-for-all. So like if you look at this paper, you actually see a much more high-dimensional case. Actually, that one only had about 20 covariates. Then the next one has 90. And we start with only 1,000 data points. So it's really, really a rough situation. And you see that TMLE has a harder time compared to this situation at maintaining its low variance. Okay, because it does select instruments into GA, and it suffers in the same kind of way. It just lessens the impact. Okay, this version of TMLE. So TMLE can. I didn't show you the exact mathematical construction because I usually like lose everyone when I do that. It's definitely available in lots of papers, and you can read about it. TMLE is more robust. This type of TMLE is more robust to small probabilities of treatment. Okay, and that's also if you know about the causal inference literature, you might be familiar with augmented inverse probability weighting, which is less robust to those small probabilities of treatment, the inverse of which makes these large weights and then blows everything up. TMLE actually does, in this version, TMLE does a really good job with that, and that's why we use it. But the most important thing, like I mentioned, TMLE is double robust, and this also provides a collaborative robustness property. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And this is really key for variable selection. Like, understanding this, I think, really directs you towards methods that work well. So the collaborative robustness criterion states that GA, so given an estimate of QA, which we'll use SuperLearner for instance, GA only needs to condition on the error in QA, in the estimate of QA. Which means, so like intuitively, you might see that if you fit QA on a certain set of variables and you're missing two confounders, you measure them, but you just don't put two in for whatever reason, you only need to put those two into G, depending on functional form. So you're adjusting for the error in QA. The error means you're missing those two covariates. So you put them in G. This is artificial. You wouldn't really do this. There are ways you could do this well, though. The combination of those two things will give you consistent estimation of psi. So that's a really cool mathematical property. Unbiased for large samples, consistent, if it's not clear. So one way where you can use this reasonably is that you might say, including certain covariates that are confounders, if I put them into G, I might get really, really large weights, and it's ruining my variance. So take them out. Put them into Q. Put them into the outcome model only. You might still get unbiased estimation, okay, with lower variance. So see, like, that's what a good variable selection method would do if you did it adaptively or if you did it on your own. That's the idea. You're trying to keep that variance down and get all of your covariates in somewhere and all the features that you want into either QA or GA. Okay, so the result in the variable selection context is even if QA only selects predictors of outcome, because that's what it's doing, and GA only selects predictors of treatment, we ultimately adjust for everything correlated with either variable, which intuitively and seems to work when we try it, like through simulation studies, that protects you from confounding. And that's why it works. Because we can't directly condition on the error in Q. If we could, we would just do it, it would be done, it would be solved. Okay, because we don't know the true value of Q. Otherwise, we would just stick that error into the propensity score and we'd be fine. Okay, but here also, we need to assume that no added variable that is correlated with A or Y will increase large sample bias. So that's not specific to the high dimensional propensity score, that is true of these variable selection methods also. Okay, so like I mentioned, the high dimensional propensity score algorithm is particularly appealing because of computational simplicity. For very large covariate spaces, it is true that running SuperLearner on GA and QA might take excessive computing time or blow up a small computer or something like that. Like, I've been a victim. So high dimensional propensity score can be considered a variable screening tool, like I mentioned, that can be used within the SuperLearner library, thus improving computation time. So actually, these two things used together might be pretty beneficial. But it's just one example of a variable screening method. And then one thing where we kind of get back some of that computational time is that we don't necessarily need to use something like Bootstrap to estimate the variance of TMLE because it has a closed form standard error formula for large sample settings. Okay. There are some like issues I have with this variance estimator. It might, like, it performs questionably well in high dimensional covariate spaces. So this is really something I want to look into more in the future. You can see what I did in that last paper I mentioned. In particular, for small sample settings, it is better to use the Bootstrap. But unfortunately, if you're using SuperLearner, TMLE, SuperLearner averaging over all of these different methods that themselves might be data adaptive, so that might take a lot of cross-validation for each method, and then you're doing this cross-validated SuperLearner, and then you're doing TMLE, and then you're bootstrapping, that can be heavy, okay? So that's when we get programmers who aren't me, and then that can be made more efficient, okay? So these are definitely issues for implementation. So for an overview of section 4, estimating GA and QA with parametric regression models can cause bias due to misspecification and be hard to fit in a high-dimensional covariate space, and that's why we sort of want to move away from that. Using SuperLearner with IPTW is not a great solution because it can inflate the standard error by selecting unnecessary instrumental variables or features, instrumental features, into the propensity score model. The high-dimensional propensity score variable prioritization variable selection method can also inflate the standard error without reducing bias, like we saw with the DAG example. We saw that TMLE using superlearners separately for GA and QA is stable, low bias, and low variance. Works well. I was trying to break it, like, honestly. So if it worked well in these settings, then it did a pretty good job. And we also saw that superlearner can perform an automated variable feature selection in high-dimensional data, because that's sort of what a lot of those methods are made for. Basically, you need to include methods that can work with a high-dimensional covariate space. So you couldn't fit an all main terms and interactions and squared terms. Logistic regression is one of your methods in superlearner. It just wouldn't run. But you can use adaptive methods in superlearner. And so that's when it would really be available for a high-dimensional covariate space. And so then after that, one can then run TMLE, effectively giving you a high-dimensional TMLE estimator. Okay, so these things are absolutely workable in high dimensions. So are there any... Well, actually, I'm done, so I may as well... Oh, I have a discussion. Okay. But I think that we're just about out of time. So I think... So this is my, like, political or whatever. So I thought that the counterfactual philosophy... in causal inference and in targeted learning also, has the potential to change routine statistical practices across the quantitative science. And we see that happening step by step. I think two major limitations in the advancement of new and better statistical methods is familiarity and ability to implement the procedures is definitely a challenge for us. Implementing these methods, making software, it's really, really important to ask for funding for these kinds of things also. To hire software developers, because obviously I can't do this. However, the performance of such methods needs to be thoroughly evaluated. And I always thought that it was important to do this with different groups evaluating these methods, so that one group that isn't pushing these methods says it works perfectly. That's why I was really trying to break them to see. That's what I was doing for a lot of my PhD. But worked very, very well. Greater value should be placed on methods with formal statistical properties rather than procedures that don't target or define a clear question, including ad hoc variable selection procedures. Okay, something that is practical isn't necessarily statistically consistent, even though it's computationally practical and it's easy to understand. It's not necessarily exactly what you want to do to target the parameter of interest. So I presented simple examples, but targeted learning and TMLE have been applied to more complex problems, including longitudinal confounding or mediation studies. So it's not as simplistic as I presented. So here you have printouts. Here are most of the references I included. And thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, first I want to thank you for giving us this wonderful and novel talk. This, for us, this is completely new. I'd like to go back a couple of questions. One is to go back to your very first part of the talk. In terms of the marginal effect versus the conditional effect, as you noted, the majority of research today presents conditional effects using density scores or using all kinds of different techniques, but the final effect is conditional. And in your assessment, how often would this conditional effect be truly different from practical purposes from the marginal effect? I mean, there are certain conditions about the effect modification or interaction, however we want to call it, that may impact on these differences. But how can you talk in practical circumstances, how different are they?
Yeah, it's hard for me to say, honestly. There was one good example, I think, in one of the high-dimensional propensity score papers where they showed conditional adjustment versus, and even before using the high-dimensional propensity score, just propensity score estimation of a marginal, because you can use propensity scores to estimate these marginal effects. And it was a very large difference. It was like they were looking at, was it a marginal odds ratio, but something that you would definitely interpret very, very differently. And so there aren't too many examples that I can really think of of where people showed in practical problems, how large of an effect it makes. But I think that when I looked at the clinical trial papers from way back when they say don't adjust for confounders in your logistic regression, because that's kind of the same problem, they said it tends to attenuate the effect estimate so that the true marginal effect is larger than the adjusted effect.
Because a lot of what is done in many of these studies is to, in sensitivity analysis, is to look at the stratified effect.
Yes.
Conditional, but stratified for all of the important variables. And if the forest plot shows there is consistency, then basically this would alleviate the fears that the marginal and conditional effects would be very different from each other. Is this, what do you think about this?
If you're looking at a purely stratified effect, like you're just estimating the effect in different strata, and that is directly looking at effect heterogeneity, that's a little bit different than assuming a logistic regression form without looking at effect heterogeneity, but assuming this sort of linear form of all of the confounders and estimating one effect coefficient. Like those two things are a bit different. One assumes the model, and one may or may not, depending on what exactly they're doing. It's a slightly different question, I think.
Was your analysis of the asthma and inhaled steroid and baby studies?
Yeah.
Can you show that to us, or is that have you done that using TMLE or using?
My student is doing that.
They are doing it right.
Yeah, now. We went right for the longitudinal analysis, so it takes a little. He's done it. He's presented his results at a conference, but those are preliminary results.
And one last comment. That in your DAG on that study, there is also an A exposure that precedes C, by the way, and that's part of the treatment of asthma, and that would have a consequence on the C variable.
Yes.
Just as
I often include that in C.
The exposure is also included in C.
Like if it's but the problem that it might be highly correlated with A, if it's entirely correlated, yeah. So that can be, and that's sort of, maybe that's a little bit why we're looking at it longitudinally.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes?
So, in estimating the IPTW, I can imagine a hypothetical situation, let's say hypothetical, where you have a confounder that is maybe not an absolute contraindication, but a relatively strong contraindication of treatment, get a low estimated probability, and you would get a very high weight for that patient if it's very low. Mm-hmm. But I could also imagine that there could be a covariate for that patient, which is an instrument, which would be a positive predictor of treatment. And if you remove the instrument, if you kept that instrument in, you might get a more reasonable weight for that patient. So,
you know what I mean?
So is it always a good idea with IPTW to remove instruments if you're actually getting more reasonable weights for?
In that case where it happens to sort of the combination of the two shows that it's actually not as extreme. Yeah.
So you pay a variance penalty, but you get a more reasonable weight.
That's maybe true. Yeah. That's maybe true. Robert?
So this is a general question. I think one of the things that people think about when you've got these models or these procedures that have a lot of moving parts is one of the things that I worry about when we start putting methods out in the wild, to SAS, for example, is things like diagnostics and how do you know when something's going wrong?
I totally share these concerns. For me so far, it's really been looking at the weights. In general, in causal inference, you want to evaluate your positivity, your overlap between your treatment groups. All of these things apply to get a good understanding of the problem, and that is preliminary. But once you fit the model, diagnostic, I think, would be looking at weights. If you have very, very, I don't have rules of thumb. I think you actually were developing rules of thumb. That was good. It's a self-admiration side. No, that was really good. But like that's the sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that is absolutely needed.
It wasn't meant to
Oh, no.
I'll add, just mentioning too, in answer to Sandy's question, Meg Lang and a number of other CNOS people have a paper coming out of epidemiology with a works, essentially a worked example in a pharmacoepidemiologic setting of a simple TFLA problem. So that should be published online, I would think, fairly soon.
And that's huge. I actually forgot to mention that. That's huge. I told you. But I mean, that's the first time there was SAS code, I think, that anyone put out, that anyone published SAS code, which is what people tend to use. Up till now, it's been R code exclusively, I think. I could be wrong, but that's why I thought that it was what I was saying, where we need to develop software, or at least make things accessible. That is a big step in that direction.
One is really basic. There's a SAS macro superlearner. Mm-hmm. Is that at all what people are here, and how close is it to the teacher?
I don't use SAS. Ming Lan, is it?
Oh, you don't know? Yeah, well, there's a superlearner macro.
That's the CNOS perspective for our coders. Is there a way that we can do this? Something out there. There is a superlearner macro, and I was just wondering if it was familiar.
Excuse me, I can check it out. Check it out quickly.
Second question has to do with the statement you made in passing. It kind of went quickly. I wasn't sure exactly what you meant. It had to do with this performance with low probability of treatment. Mm-hmm. But did you mean an individual in a propensity score model with a low probability?
Yeah.
Or where the sample probability of treatment is really low?
I really mean the individual.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it perform consistently across the sample probability of treatment?
Like for rare treatment?
Yeah, we've done a couple of different studies, one where probability of treatment was low. One is 100 people, mm-hmm. and that one where the probability of treatment was about 60% treated. When you did your simulations, did you test the probabilities with respect to the system?
I think that's why these methods are considered, I think that's one of the situations where these methods are considered most useful, because I think outcome regression models would do poorly when you have rare treatment, a very, very rare variable. And so here you do well, but your I guess, stability is still going to come from the number of people treated or with the lowest probability, treated, untreated. But I think that that's a good question. There is a paper on this. I don't know if it's been published, but there's a working paper on that, where there's a specific TMLE that uses that information, knowing that the probability of treatment is very low. I mean, is this really? I might be getting things confused, but yeah, sorry, that's a good question. I can figure that out. We could talk later.
But I've got my answer. So it's the individual probability within.
Yes. I think what I was thinking about was rare outcomes, so it was different. So, yeah.
Very nice talk, very interesting. The way I understand it is that you propose to let the data drive the analysis, rather than imposing an analysis on the data.
Yes.
Okay, but eventually, at the end of the day, you're going to get a measure of association,
mm-hmm.
which might be less confounded with the methods you propose than less, but all you have is a measure of association,
mm-hmm.
on which you're going to start your causality discussion. A great deal of the factors that come into the causality are extraneous to this stuff. That is, it can be a physiological aspect, physiological or biological plausibility.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the outcome stuff. Because you mentioned, for instance, that outcome assessment is the main point. This is often not the case. Mm-hmm. The outcome might precede the assessment by many years. For instance, in breast cancer, we know that breast cancer is present 17 years before it is diagnosed. So when you're doing your outcome assessment, it's way after. The woman in diabetes is the same thing. You're diabetic for 17 years before you make the diagnosis. So all this temporality thing, which appears to be very simple, is actually a huge challenge that cannot be addressed with this data. Because all you have is a measure of association.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all you have.
Yeah.
And epidemiology cannot do anything more than that. The causality thing is much more complex. It just starts there. It's the beginning of the discussion. It's not the end of the discussion.
I agree.
And the other problem, too, is that different people can have different standards. It talk to a cardiologist or some in the room, this is not a randomized controlled trial, okay? All the epidemiologists will think that anything, any association is necessarily causal. So what I'm missing here is the next step.
Mm-hmm. Is the sort of broader discussion.
You probably have a better measure of association, which is already a big step. But you still have to start the causality discussion. The other thing I'm not sure I got is how does your method compensate for your measure confounder, which is our biggest problem, not my method.
Yeah, no, it absolutely doesn't. If you, with the exception of what you can grab from a high-dimensional propensity score sort of thing, where you include as many indicators as possible, aside from that, if there's something that is absolutely not proxy measured anywhere, you will do, I think, pretty much as poorly with TMLE. Not, I don't think you do worse, but you do as, you have this, basically you're better at targeting the wrong parameter or the biased parameter for the causal effect. Okay. So yeah, absolutely. The only thing is that when you use superlearner in G and Q, it's not just covariates that can confound, it's also an interaction. If the interaction is relevant for treatment and outcome, that interaction can be a confounder. And if you're not looking for these things, if they exist, superlearner might pick it up, but a non-superlearner main effects model won't. And so you do get some sort of confounding reduction by modeling better.
Proxies for your non-confounder.
Oh, sure.
You depend on that.
Yeah.
You might very well have some that you don't suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The last point, maybe if I have more, is I would like to see some examples, you know, using the standard logistic regression, you get an R or loss ratio such, and using this method, how different is it?
Mm-hmm.
And is it consistently higher or lower? I think we need some more of those data to see if it's worth
all the trouble. Yeah, I think one of the issues is that causal inference people talk amongst themselves a lot. And so the discussion is... And so we're not saying, hey, this is... I mean, people do talk out, but not everyone. So I agree. I have not been doing studies where I show the conditional effect. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Thank you. Any other questions?